Welcome to another TeachingAmericanHistory.org podcast. TAH.org is the leading online resource for documents, resources, and programs related to American history, government, and civics for teachers, students, and citizens. We are here today with Sarah Morgan Smith, the editor of our new Women's Voices, Religion in American History and Politics Core Documents volume. Sarah is a fellow at the Ashbrook Center and fills a number of important roles with Ashbrook and TeachingAmericanHistory.org. I'm going to give her a moment to introduce herself, and then we're going to go right into some of the details of this really interesting volume that we now have available. Sarah?
Hey, Jeremy. Thanks so much for letting me join you today.
Of course.
I am delighted to be here and to talk about the Women's Voices volume, which I snagged for myself in my other role as, you know, one of the editors of Core Documents Collection overall. This is a volume that I really wanted to have my own selection of documents get into the collection. So I'm really happy to talk about it.
Terrific. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and how you came into the position you're in right now? Because I think it's important for people to understand, like, who is this person as a in terms of their education, and so then how did they arrive in this position?
Sure. So I am a scholar of the history of political thought, focusing on basically American politics and theology and the places where the two intersect. And I have been doing variations on that kind of research for over 15 years. I started in the museum world, actually, trying to interpret the ways our political and theological ideas work out into sort of the things around us, the places we live and the stuff of life. And then I decided that I'd really rather talk about the documents themselves, although I still am really interested in how the material world reflects ideas. So there are like images in this volume, for instance, because I think images really can help to illustrate things, obviously, that maybe words alone can't.
Can't communicate, right? I think that's terrific. Actually, that's a really interesting point that this volume does include images, because I think those are particularly useful in a classroom, especially with a diverse group of students. And lastly, before we actually get into my questions about the volume, your doctoral work, why don't you just give us a little glimpse on that so we have this really clear picture of who's the editor, where is she coming from on this?
Sure. So my PhD is from Rutgers, and it's actually from the Political Science Department, but I was able to work there with a historian of political thought who's also very interested in the history of religion and how, again, that plays out in our political commitments. And I've wrote in my dissertation about Puritan civic formation. So basically, how did the earliest colonists in Massachusetts, how did they take their theological understanding and apply it to the new institutions that they were creating in government, education, in the church itself, obviously, and then what did the experience of being in America and actually having to deal with all of the chaos of, building a new society, what did that do to those ideas, right? So what's the back and forth between the ideas and the institutions? And I look at that over about the first 70 years of Massachusetts history.
Wow. Well, I know that in most, in most textbooks and in most survey courses of American history, especially the first half of American history, the role of religion, the role of formal religious institutions and churches, things like that, maybe a few notable individuals, those things typically, I'd say they're on or very near the top shelf of things presented to students. So let me ask you, in regards to this volume, Women's Voices, why study women's role in religion in depth? Why would you say to a teacher, hey, you need to make sure to take a look at it from this angle, this women's perspective as well? What's the case you would make for that?
Well, so there's a woman whose name is Anne Broad, who is really one of the pioneers of looking at American women's religious experience. And she has a great quote, which is basically to say that anybody who's interested in American women's history has to be interested in America's religious history, because women in America have always made up more than 50% of religious adherents, formal members of religious denominations. And that's still true today, and it's true across religious backgrounds. So it's true for the Christian denominations, Protestants, Catholics. It's also true of new religions that are created in America, like the Shakers and the Mormons and other groups, Seventh-day Adventists. And it's also true of Judaism and Islam and Hinduism in, you know, our present more multicultural religious environment. So if you want to think about the role of religion in our culture, you're going to have to talk about the role of women in those various religious traditions, because women make up such a large part of that demographic. And I also think that it's a good way to get women into the curriculum, right? I mean, so much of the stuff that we have to talk about in history is dominated by, you know, the stories of great men, and they are great and we should talk about them, but this is a way to sort of also include what the other half of the population was doing.
Okay. Why use documents to do this? How does that enhance this topic in particular?
So one of the things about religious belief is that it's internal, right, obviously. And there's religious practice, but prior to the advent of the camera and then later the motion picture, you wouldn't be able to capture that practice in the act, right? There are obviously devotional paintings or images, but they're done after the fact. They don't show you the actual worship gathering, right? So the closest that we can get to being in the moment of a religious exercise is to be reading the documents that these women left behind, describing their religious experiences, and then also describing how those experiences influenced them to act in other aspects of their lives, not just their worship practices.
And better to hear directly from them than someone's interpretation of what they say they said.
Exactly.
Okay.
So it's easy for us when we think about the past, you know, to apply our own lens to interpret what someone's doing, or to say, well, you know, for instance, a lot of people who study sort of what's termed Christian orthodoxy say that it's very patriarchal and oppressive of women. And so it's easy then to say, okay, well, these women must all have felt oppressed, right? Or they didn't realize they were being oppressed. But if we actually look at what they wrote, I think it becomes very clear that, on the contrary, they found their religious beliefs to give them a lot of agency, that they felt empowered and called to go out and do things because of their belief in these particular doctrines, not despite them, or, you know, that they felt hindered by those beliefs. So it actually can kind of turn that narrative upside down.
Kind of breaks the presentist mold or frame that we can unintentionally enforce on the past by, again, talking directly to or hearing directly from. How many documents are in this volume?
There are 35 documents, and then a selection of 8 images to go along with
them. Okay. What guided, did you have like a kind of a lens or a framework? What guided your selection of these documents and those images?
Well, so first of all, this collection is limited to documents that are written by women.
Okay.
So they're about women's religious experience, but they're also, you know, by women. And then the women that I chose, I kind of arbitrarily decided that they had to be someone who would have been identified as a leader in their religious tradition at the time, so that they were someone who kind of embodied the best of whatever tradition they were affiliated with. And in that way, I'm hoping that they can be considered representative. I mean, you know, what survives from the past is always a game of chance. And obviously, you know, the documents and things by, you know, more well-off families or families that had their own sense of their importance to history, have a better chance of surviving. And so any sample is a little prejudiced, but I hope that by choosing women who aligned with the sort of doctrinal standards of their traditions, we can make a case that says, okay, well, this is at least what any woman of that religious background would have been aspiring to, or would have been, you know, seeing as an exemplar.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, just hearing that, if you have some evidence that a given woman was seen as a leader at the time, then I think it's an easy sell to make to say, well, this person was recognized as a leader. Her ideas, therefore, were those that others subscribed to because they saw her as being a thought leader or something like that, to use our terminology now, rather than grabbing something from the past and then we assign value and weight to it based on, again, our lens instead of, well, how did they read that at the time?
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Okay, so out of the 35, and you can I'll give you a pass on this. You can choose one of the, you said 8 images?
Yep.
Okay, so out of the total of 43, what is the single most important, call it, document in the whole collection? Only one.
Oh, it's like picking your favorite child.
That's right.
So I think the most important is probably document 13 in the collection. It's by Angelina Grimke.
I love her.
Yeah, right?
One She's of the great.
Grimke sisters. And it's an edited version of her pamphlet, The Appeal to Christian Women of the South. And the reason that I think this document's the most important is because she so clearly articulates the connection between what she understood to be truth in her religious background. So she articulates why she believes certain things to be true, namely in this case, why all humans should be considered equal in dignity and worth because they're all made in the image of God. And then she says, if that's true, then I also believe that slavery is wrong. And if slavery is wrong, well, then I have a moral obligation to do something about it. And she lays out a 4-step plan, saying this is what women can do to try and abolish slavery. And she's speaking to Southern women, right? So to women who are themselves probably slave owners. She grew up as the daughter of a slave owner. And it wasn't until she, you know, moved away from the South as a young adult that she renounced that background. And so she's speaking to women who maybe themselves own slaves, but who hopefully can, you know, be moved by the same line of reasoning that she was to realize that that's wrong. And so she tells them, you know, here are 4 things you can do. You can read. Now it's 1836 when she writes this pamphlet, and we're already seeing censorship of anti-slavery messaging in the South. So, and she says, look, you may not be able to read secondary works about this, but you can read your Bible, and that's all you need to have to convince you that slavery is wrong, right? So you can read, you can pray, you know, for the internal characteristics and virtues that will enable you to have courage, you know, pray that you will be able to have the right words to articulate your convictions. And then you can speak, right? So you can use your role as a wife, as a mother, as a friend, as a sibling, a neighbor, to just have influence on the people around you, to share what you've become convinced of. And then she also encourages them to act. She says, you know, if you are a woman who actually owns her own slaves, you know, not some women had private slaves, right, separate right. from their husbands, then you should emancipate them. And if you're not in a position to actually emancipate your own slaves, then at least what you can do is model treating them with dignity. You know, you can educate your slaves, even though that's illegal in most states at the time, that you can subvert the laws because the laws are unjust, right? And I love that she says this. I mean, this is St. Augustine. This is Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. This is anybody in the Christian tradition, really going back to, I would say, St. Paul, thinking about what is the difference between a just law and an unjust law,
right,
and how do we react to that? So I think that she's the most important document because of this question of justice and sort of our own moral responsibility to evaluate the law and to act according to our conscience. But I also think she's the most important just because of the critical nature of the slavery question in American history. So she has this role as an early abolitionist author where she's demonstrating that women can push on social norms and mores and make a difference. And then, of course, we know that because women are actually excluded from a lot of the abolitionist organizations, that that becomes the start of the formal move towards women's suffrage, mm-hmm, right? So she's really at the hinge point of all these interesting elements.
I think what's fascinating, a couple of things stand out to me about her, is that one, I mean, that the argument she presents in that piece is so, I mean, you kind of get beaten down by it. It's so hard to not come away and be like, how could anyone, unless they were just like inhuman, how could you not agree with, if any of these things that she lays out are so, it's a really powerful argument. You make a really good point too, the fact that she and this argument and what she ended up doing and trying to do, I mean, this could be used in a history class looking at women. This could be used in maybe a religion class. This could be used in a government class talking about, you know, reform movements, talking about work as a civic, like a cultural or social reformer. What are the different American traditions of acting in a reformer capacity? Yeah, she checks so many boxes.
And I think she's someone who could inspire students to do that same sort of thing, right? So whatever the issue is that they become convinced is unjust in their consciences, you know, the things that she's asking them to do are not superhuman things, right? Educate yourself, find out about the truth of the issue. You know, think, if, you know, she uses the word pray, but if you're not religious, you could reflect, you know, think and plan. Don't just fly off the handle. You know, don't just demonstrate in the streets, but think about how to approach this question so that you can have a reasoned civil discourse with people who disagree with you, you know, and then have that engagement. And then where you can change your behavior, change it, right? So if you're concerned about work conditions, you know, pay attention to brands that have ethical working conditions and shop from them, or, you know, those kinds of things. We can all do those things.
Yeah, I think there are, from those four suggestions, there are a lot of contemporary, call them translations of those things that you can extrapolate.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So, okay, out of the 35 or the 8 pictures, given the overall topic of the volume, where would you recommend someone starts? Because this isn't like unfortunately, and this should be an A-list topic. I think you made the case earlier, I'm convinced. But this isn't a topic I think a lot of people think about as a single coherent topic. So if you're saying, listen, I want you to get up to speed on, or begin to get up to speed on, this idea of women's voices in religion and American history and politics and how those things really come together, where would you recommend someone starts in the volume?
So document 21 is a speech that Frances Willard gave when she was president of the Women's Christian Temperance Union in the late 19th century, called the Do Everything Policy. I know, right? This is a kind of a quirky little title.
That sounds like it should have a hashtag in front of it. I know that's horrible sounding, but it actually kind of does.
It does, actually. Do everything. Hashtag do everything. She would love that, I think, because the point of this speech is that the Women's Christian Temperance Union could not restrict its activism to just outlawing the sale of alcohol, right? But that really the organization needed to pay attention to all of the tangential factors. So why did men want to go to bars and spend their paychecks on alcohol instead of going home to their wives, right? This was a big problem in the 19th century. So she says it's because the working conditions in the factories are so demoralizing and dehumanizing. And so if we really want to change the family, we want to make women's lives better, we can't just say we're not going to sell your husband's alcohol because their husbands will still be demoralized, mm-hmm. right? We need to actually be interested in labor reform. And so she's an advocate for labor reform. She's also concerned about the education of children and, you know, what happens to all these young people if we say they're not going to be at work in the factory. Well, where do they go when the parents are at work in the factory, right? So her policy is do everything so that you can do the one thing that you want, which is to create flourishing families. Because that's really what the Women's Christian Temperance Union's goal was. I mean, we think of temperance as just, you know, prohibition, right?
Right.
Just outlawing something.
Or Carry Nation.
Or Carry Nation. But they were actually for something, mm-hmm. which was stable, healthy, you know, whole family life.
Interesting. So that would be a good place for someone to start to get a sense of just how, like, it almost seems to me like the I don't want to say tendrils because that sounds like nefarious or something, but that the echoes of these actions of the actions of these women they've moved into so many different areas of our public and our political life. I don't think many people recognize this.
Absolutely.
And so you're saying a document like that would enable someone to look at this and say, wow, I see there's so much going on beneath the waves here. So many different ways that this thing I've heard of was connected to so many other things that I've heard of. But I had no idea that this was kind of like a connective tissue that you could bring it together through this person or through this document.
Yeah, it helps to fill in some of those dots.
Cool.
Absolutely.
All right. Okay. So final question, curiosity. Because everyone has a different response to this, and I've always found this fascinating. In preparing this volume, in going about selecting the documents and writing the summaries that precede each document and the questions that go with each and things like that, all the different materials, what did you learn, if anything? Was there a surprise? Did you come away with you felt like a new understanding? If so, what?
So my expertise is really on the Christian Protestant tradition. And in putting together this collection, I wanted to make sure that it wasn't just about Christian Protestants.
Right.
I wanted to make sure that different groups were represented. So there are some Jewish documents, some Catholic documents, Mormons. And the last document is by a contemporary Muslim scholar, Amina Wadud. And I think what I learned is that regardless of the particular doctrines of a woman's religious tradition, if she really genuinely believes them and is convicted by them, it has to change the way she lives her life. And that there's really more that unites these women who are acting under this sense of divine calling and purpose, than there is that divides them, which I think, I mean, I knew that, right, as an intellectual concept, but seeing it in their own words and seeing how similar the language is that they use to describe what they're doing and why they're doing it, and all of it in the service of the common good, you know, we are used to thinking of religion as something that's kind of interfering in the public or that should only be private, you know, that shouldn't cross that line. And for these women, it absolutely had to. It had to affect how they lived in public and the types of positions that they felt governments should take. And I loved seeing that. None of them were trying to push out religion from the public square. They were really trying to just live faithfully.
It's fascinating. Well, thank you thank you for your time. Thank you for the work on this volume. I'm really looking forward to looking through it when it's available, or rather it is available now. So teachers and other folks listening, remember that you can download a PDF version of this volume for free. If you are a Mac user, you can download the iTunes ebook for free. The Kindle version through Amazon is 99 cents, and the print-on-demand through Amazon is $10. If you're interested in any of those volumes, oh, and incidentally, the PDF, if teachers, if you want to distribute that to students, go right ahead. You don't need permission from us. I just gave you permission. So,
Jeremy, can I, one other thing about that. This document is actually going to be on, or the document collection will be on TAH, as individual documents.
Right.
So teachers can go there and just pick the one document, and sort of pair it with other things, without having to, you know, break apart their book or.
When someone goes to the documents collection page on the site, they can see this as an individual collection, click on it, and then from that they'll have options to download it in full or just grab separate or individual documents from it.
Right, absolutely. Great.
And links to all of that are going to be with this the blog post that this this podcast is coming from. So anyway, Sarah, thank you again for your work. Thank you for your time today. And teachers, go ahead and take a look at this, download it, and really think about how you can incorporate these documents into your history and government lessons, and bring this perspective that really deserves attention, because it's authentic and it's valid and it's really, really useful. So bring this perspective to your classrooms. Thanks so much, and we'll.
Thank you, Jeremy.
You bet. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to another TAH.org podcast. You can find archives of all our previous programs, as well as information about future programs, at TAH.org/webinars, or on iTunes by searching for TeachingAmericanHistory.org.